We continue our study this morning of the apostles of Jesus. Now perhaps some of us would say, why would we want to study something like that? First of all, we want to study them because they were important to Jesus. Jesus chose 12 men to be his disciples. He kept them with him throughout his entire public ministry. Many of his miracles, many of his teachings, a lot of his parables were told especially to them and for them. And then at the end of his ministry, he entrusted to them the telling of the gospel to others. The Great Commission, as we call it, was given to those apostles. And so that's the first reason we want to know more about them. Secondly, we want to know more about them because a lot is made of them in the Scriptures. When we read, especially in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're constantly being mentioned. That has to be because the Holy Spirit, as He guided the writing of these Gospels, wanted it to be known what these men did, what they were taught, what kind of people they were. For a third reason we would want to study them is because of the sometimes misuse of our information about these men by some in the religious world even today. I don't guess I have a strong dislike. I mean, I have obviously a strong dislike, but I can't give you a strong disapproval of some church somewhere naming themselves after St. John the Apostle. I really don't see the purpose of that, but or they might have St. Bartholomew or St. Thomas. And yet when we look in the Scriptures, that kind of attention was not given to these men. While a lot of attention is given to them by Jesus and a lot of attention is given to them by the gospel writers, the early church did not give that kind of attention to them. In some ways, it's amazing how little we actually know about these men. Because it turns out it wasn't about them, but it was about Jesus. It was about the good news about Him, and it was about the advancing of that message throughout all the world. When we look at the entire Bible, it tends to be that same way. The important person in the Gospels is Jesus. And while there's these men around Him, and we hear bits and pieces about them, it's really about Jesus we know the most, isn't it? When we look in the Old Testament, it's the same kind of way. A few people are key people in what God was doing. Abraham, David, Moses, and we seem to know quite a bit about them as a result. But many of the people around them who were actually very important people and key to what was happening, we know very little about. Years and years ago, I read a book that was a collection of sermons of a great preacher of the 1800s who was a part of what we call the Restoration Movement that the Churches of Christ are a part of. His name was James W. McGarvey. And one of those sermons in that book, I've mentioned before to you, the title of that sermon was called something like The Style of the Spirit. And this sermon really caught my attention because I'd never read anyone else ever speak about this before, and I don't think I've even seen anyone else since. But he talked about how when we read the Scriptures, there's some things about the Scriptures that are very unique, whether you're reading in Genesis or at the end of the New Testament or anywhere in between. No matter who the author was, no matter what the subject was about, there are certain things that these passages all have in common. And he called that the style of the Spirit. In other words, even though John might be writing this part or Moses might be writing that part, truly it was the Holy Spirit speaking through them who was causing these things to be written. And that Spirit had his own unique style. And part of that style was to not give attention to men, but to what God was doing. And so in our study of the apostles, we will notice that ultimately what was important was not what color hair did these men have or how tall were they or who was good looking and who was not so good looking. In fact, no attention at all is given to those things, is it? But what was really important is what is God doing? And how do these men have a part in what God is doing? And so even as we talk about the 12 who dared, We have to acknowledge the fact that we're trying to piece together what little information we have from the Scriptures about some of these men. We've talked for the last 2 weeks about Peter. Of those 12, we know the most about him. From this point, the knowledge, the information we have gets very thin. Today we're going to talk about two more, James and John. And we'll only spend 1 week talking about two men. And starting next week, we'll have to talk about four or five men all at once, all in one lesson, because we have so little that we actually know about them. And I think ultimately that wouldn't bother them. Because by the time Jesus left this earth, they realized it wasn't about them. It was about Him. And all they wanted was for other people to know about Him, Jesus, not about them. And so we ought to honor that and recognize that fact. The three most prominent disciples of Jesus, of these 12, were Peter, James, and John. Years ago, when I was only an early teenager, I had the responsibility at a very small congregation to teach for a while the small children's class. Now, the small children's class, most Sundays, turned out to be one little boy. His name was Bo. I guess when we first went to that congregation, Bo was probably, two or three. And so by the time I was assigned or volunteered, I was volunteered to teach Bo. He was probably 3.5 to 4. So we worked on all the usual things we try to work on with very small children that people had worked with me when I was that age, growing up in the church. Teach him the books of the Bible, teach him the Bible stories, teach him the Bible songs. Well, his favorite song, as near as I can remember all these many years later, was Peter, James, and John in a Sailboat. Fished all night and caught no fishes. Bo's dad was a highway patrolman. But I think I remember that Bo's dad liked to fish when he wasn't on patrol. And so he liked that idea that even in the Bible there were men who liked to fish. And he liked the story of Jesus causing them to catch a great catch of fish when they were not able to do that on their own. He's also the one that could never figure out why, when we were learning the books of the New Testament, why when you got down to 1st and 2nd Timothy, Titus and Philemon and Hebrews and James, he never could understand that Hebrews did not bruise James. For in his own mind, that sounded like what we were saying, he bruised James. He loved to sing Bringing in the Cheese when we were singing in the auditorium, because he thought that's what we were saying. Peter, James, and John in a sailboat. These were the three most prominent of Jesus' 12 disciples, and the three we probably know the most about by far. So what do we know about James and John? First of all, we talk about them together because they were brothers. They were brothers. Their father's name was Zebedee. That's mentioned 5 times in the New Testament. The fact that it's mentioned so many times, starting in Matthew chapter 4 and verse 21, that they were the sons of Zebedee probably meant that Zebedee was a rather important person in that area around Capernaum and Bethsaida where these men lived. He was probably well recognized, well known, and it might well be because he owned a very successful fishing business. It says in Matthew chapter 4 and verse 21, going on from there, Jesus saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in a boat with their father Zebedee preparing their nets. Jesus called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. Well, in other places where this is all mentioned about their father Zebedee and about fishing and so forth, it mentions actually that they had several boats. And it also mentioned that there were servants also of their father that was working along with them. This would indicate more than just very poor men scratching out a living fishing. This would indicate a business. It even tells us that they were in partnership with Peter and his brother Andrew in this fishing business. So here we have 5 prominent men, Zebedee, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, plus servants all working. That gets to be a small business pretty quickly. So first of all, we know of these men that their father's name was Zebedee, that they were part of a successful fishing business there on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. And they had a business connection already with two others of the apostles of Jesus, Peter and Andrew. We find out later, during the time when Jesus, at the end of his, near the end of his life, when he's arrested and carried to trial, that it tells us in John chapter 18 and verse 15 that John, of this James and John, when Jesus is taken in to the high priest's house for really what amounted to an illegal trial, John is invited in to the house. The servants of that house knew who John was. Now that's very interesting, because John and James are from Galilee, up in around Capernaum. And yet here we are down in Jerusalem at the house of the high priest, the most important person in the Jewish culture. And yet John is known in that house and is known well enough and respected enough, he's invited in. John actually gets to go in and see the trials of Jesus. Now, how could that be? This tells us he was not just a poor Galilean fisherman. Probably because of his father and their business, they were well known as prominent people from up in Capernaum and had some kind of personal relationship or friendship with the high priest himself. Early tradition says, and that's all it amounts to, early tradition says that Zebedee was actually of the tribe of Levi, which would mean he was of the same general family then as the high priest. That would also therefore mean that James and John were also of the tribe of Levi. That doesn't mean they were priests, but they were of that tribe. And so they would have status or standing even down in Jerusalem. And so John could be invited into the house that night, even though in other terms he might be seen as actually a threat, since he was a disciple of Jesus, and yet he had enough influence, enough standing, that they would invite him in to view the proceedings that took place. This was their father, Zebedee. We know very little else about him other than him being a prominent businessman in the fishing business. Their mother's name was Salome. Salome. She's mentioned by name twice in the Gospels. And in both places, when it mentions her name, it says that she was the mother of the sons of Zebedee. And so that lets us know clearly what their mother's name was. Her name was Salome. But there's some other things we also know about this Salome. It tells us in Matthew chapter 27, at the crucifixion of Jesus, Matthew 27 verse 55, many women were there, watching from a distance. Now, these were not women who were there because they liked to see something gruesome like men being crucified on crosses. These are actually women who have accompanied Jesus and his apostles throughout most of his ministry. We see them on several occasions as being with him. So there was a larger group many times than just Jesus and the 12. There were also these women. And they were women of means who actually out of their own pockets were helping fund some of the ministry of Jesus. Included in that number would be Salome. Again, that would feed into the idea that Zebedee was a very successful businessman. So she would be a woman who had access to sufficient means to help pay for some of the needs that this larger group of people would have as they travel about with Jesus. But it says there, many women were there watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, and we know who she was, Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. Now at first we say, well, who is that? That's actually Jesus' mother. It's interesting that in this particular account, it doesn't actually say this was Jesus' mother, but that's who that is. For Jesus had brothers, including brothers named James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. So we know that she was the mother of James and John. We know that she was a person of means, and she helped support Jesus in his ministry. And we know that she was there in Jerusalem at the time he was crucified. Later we read in Acts chapter 1, after Jesus has ascended back to heaven, that the 11, You know, because Judas has hanged himself, but the 11 other apostles go back into the city, and they meet there with a larger group, making up about 120, and it says, including the women. Who do you think they are? It's these same women. But, now let me share one more thing with you. In one of the accounts, the one in John chapter 19, of the women who are there at the cross, in John's account of who was there, he speaks a little differently. In verse 25 of John 19, it says, near the cross of Jesus stood his mother. Okay, now we notice Matthew didn't call her his mother, but John does. I think there's a reason for that. I think the reason why John actually refers to her as Jesus' mother is because Jesus actually ends up putting John in charge of taking care of his mother, doesn't he? Even as Jesus is hanging on the cross, he will look down and there is his mother. And here's John, one of these two we're talking about today, James and John. And Jesus says to John, John, there's your mother now. And he speaks to his own mother and says, Mother, he's now your son. In other words, he's the one who's going to take care of you. Jesus, as a firstborn in his own family, it would be his responsibility normally to take care of his mother once she was widowed. And we have every reason to believe by this time Joseph is dead, and so she is a widow. But what's happening? Jesus is dying. But more than that, within 50 days after his resurrection, he's going to be ascending back to heaven. He will no longer be around to take care of his own mother. So he's putting John in charge of taking care of her. And so John says, near the cross was his mother, and then he says, secondly, his mother's sister. Okay, well that's kind of interesting. We didn't know until now that Mary, Jesus' mother, had a sister. But it says there, along with his mother was his mother's sister, and Mary, the wife of Clopas. Clopas, it turns out from another place in the scriptures where it tells about him, was a man who worked as a chamberlain or a chief servant in the household of Herod the king. So here is another lady of means who's following Jesus, and Mary of Magdala. That's Mary Magdalene. Okay. Now, what is there about this passage I want you to see? We can explain everybody in this group we've just read about except Mary's sister. And when we read in Matthew, and if we were to have gone and read in Mark, both of them would have mentioned that the other woman who was there at the cross was Salome, or the wife of Zebedee. Most historians believe that Salome was not only the wife of Zebedee and the mother of James and John, but she was the sister of Mary, the mother of Jesus. What does that mean about James and John then? They would have been Jesus' first cousins. And also near relatives of John the Baptist, wouldn't they? Because John was a cousin of Jesus, so that would mean he's a cousin of theirs too. Now that's not a proven fact. We're having to work from just what the scriptures say, but it fits all the facts, and it seems to be the most normal explanation of them. So when Jesus chooses disciples to follow him, among those he chooses, it seems, are two of his own first cousins, sons of his aunt, Salome, to be his disciples. And perhaps that also would help explain why they were so willing to follow him. They were fishermen. They were partners, as we've already said, with Peter and Andrew, the scriptures say. We know that at least John of James and John was a disciple of John the Baptist. Again, there's that connection of not just the fact that John the Baptist was a messenger from God and a prophet, but perhaps even a near kinsman in their family. If that's the case, then here in this family, this sort of extended family made up of Mary and her sister and their sons and other kinsmen like Elizabeth and her family, the mother of John the Baptist, tremendous things are happening, not just in Israel, but within their own family. God is working in an amazing way. And these men become a part not only of Jesus's group of 12, but these two, James and John, along with Peter, become the inner circle. For we all have noticed in the Scriptures how often Jesus would just take 3 of the 12 with him for certain things. And it was always Peter, James, and John. Those he did things with, he didn't always do even with others. And so we notice some of the things that Jesus did with James and John along with Peter. In Mark chapter 5, Jesus takes these three, leaves his other disciples behind, it specifically says, and takes only these three with him into the home of a synagogue ruler whose daughter had died. And Jesus performs the miracle of raising this little girl from the dead in the presence of her own family and in the presence of Peter, James, and John. Clearly the Scriptures are saying, by the way it's written, there was a specific reason, even though it doesn't say what it is, that Jesus wanted those three there to see that. Later, in Matthew chapter 17, when he takes them up to a very high mountain, in what we now refer to as the transfiguration of Jesus, he takes only 3 of the 12 with him up that mountain. The other 9 are left down at the foot of the mountain with the crowds. Doesn't mean he doesn't like them. Doesn't mean that they're not his disciples. They are. But for some reason, he takes only 3 with him up on the mountain. And again, it's Peter, James, and John. Matthew 17, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. So Jesus takes just these three in so they could really see the extent of his power when he raised that little girl from the dead. Now he takes just these three with him up on the mountain so they can see the extent of his glory. Later, when they get down to Jerusalem for that last week that they're going to be there, as they're walking through the temple, and it was a work in progress because King Herod the Great had started a complete renovation and expansion of the whole temple area, and that work had continued for a great period of time, and it was still going on when Jesus was walking there. But what the results were was a beautiful place, one of the wonders of the ancient world, even though it never was officially designated that way by historians. And the apostles, being very modest men from up in Galilee and so forth, are impressed by what they're seeing, even though they've seen it many times before. And they're talking to Jesus about it. So afterwards, when they go out on the hillside of the Mount of Olives, it's Peter, James, and John, and Andrew, who come separately to Jesus and ask him, what did he mean when he said that pretty soon not one stone would be left on top of another of that temple? And he tells them the teaching that we have in Matthew chapter 24. There, he's actually showing these three men, plus one more, Andrew, the brother of Peter, his sovereignty, his authority, because he said this is what he was going to do. A few days later, when he's arrested, that arrest is going to take place again on the Mount of Olives in a garden area there, which we often refer to as Gethsemane. It was the place where the wine press, or the olive press rather, was kept. And when he goes there that night to pray with his 11, because Judas has already left to go betray him, of those 11, he leaves 8 here. He takes 3 more with him on over here where he's going to be praying. And who are those 3? Peter, James, and John. There's something very special about these 3 men in the mind of Jesus. He showed them things. He let them understand things the others did not see as well or understand as well. And there that night in the garden, they saw his agony over the mission that he had to accomplish. After his resurrection, it will be all 11, including these 3, who will see him after his resurrection on a number of occasions. They were the ones, along with all the others, who had seen him during his ministry feed the 5,000, heal hundreds of, perhaps even thousands of people, still the storm, walk on water, preach the Sermon on the Mount, deliver numerous parables, celebrate the Last Supper with them. And John was the only one of the 3 who was actually there that in his presence when he actually dies on the cross. We have no indication at all that Peter or James or any of the other 11, as far as that's concerned, actually went to the crucifixion. They were too afraid. But John was there. We have a couple of things we know about James alone, besides what we've already talked about here. We know in the early chapters of the book of Acts that he was a witness to the resurrection along with the others, because all of them are described as eyewitnesses of his resurrection. We know that on the day of Pentecost, he was with the other 11 preaching the gospel that day, as it's recorded in Acts chapter 2. In the chapters after that, it mentions that all of the apostles were doing miraculous signs. So that would mean James included. We know that when the persecution broke out against the church and the apostles were arrested and beaten and imprisoned, that would include James. But the most outstanding thing we know about him is found there in Acts chapter 12 that Don read to us at the beginning of our service. Because when Jesus rose from the dead and then went back to heaven around AD 30, as the way we keep time, the church soon begins and it starts to grow and spread out. Finally, a descendant, a grandson of the old Herod the Great who tried to kill the infant Jesus, comes to the throne. His name was Herod Agrippa. And pretty soon after he became king, in order to try to patronize basically the Jewish people that he was king over, he actually started to persecute Christians. And that's recorded here in Acts chapter 12. And the very first person he executes as a part of this persecution was James, one of the apostles. And so it says, it was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. Now the expression put to death with a sword means they cut his head off. Not a pleasant prospect. But that was a typical Roman way of executing people who really weren't criminals. Real criminals got crucifixion. But a normal way of capital punishment was just to cut their head off. James is decapitated. He's the first of the apostles who were faithful to Jesus to die. Now the interesting thing about that is that back when James was still just a personal disciple of Jesus, he and his brother John had been nicknamed by Jesus the sons of Boanerges. Now, we don't use that word Boanerges today. That was an Aramaic term which basically translated meant Jesus called them the sons of thunder. These two men that we're talking about, James and John, apparently were very passionate, fervent, bold, even thunderous men. We've already seen that in Peter when we were talking about him. He was a very passionate man. He was a very loudmouth man in some ways. Apparently these men were too. And isn't it interesting that Jesus would pick these three, the loudmouths, the open mouth insert foot guys, to be his inner circle. He saw something in them that if he could turn it in the right way, would make them great servants of his. And in fact, he did turn them that way. These are the men, James and John, who while they were following Jesus, when they were traveling through Samaria one time, they were sent ahead to see if they couldn't arrange to spend the night in one of the towns of Samaria, and the Samaritans refused to let them have housing there. Well, James and John, when they hear this, they want to call down fire from heaven on these people. There's a story in the Old Testament in 2 Kings chapter 1 of the great prophet Elijah, who when he was in Samaria and was disrespected by the king Ahaziah, actually called down fire from heaven and consumed a company of 50 soldiers who had come to arrest him. And then when the king sent out 50 more to arrest him, fire came down from heaven and consumed them as well. And so perhaps James and John, knowing their own Bible history and knowing in what part of their own country they were in Samaria, they're basically saying to Jesus, look, they're disrespecting you just like the Samaritans and old King Ahaziah had disrespected Elijah. Why don't we do the same thing he did? And Jesus says, you don't know what spirit you're drinking of. You don't know that I did not come to destroy men, but to save them. But that's the kind of men these were. So maybe it's no surprise that when Herod wants to please the Jews and he starts looking out in the Christian community, he says, okay, who's the most outstanding, outspoken, visible leader of these people? Well, he was easy to spot. His name was James. And he takes him and has him publicly executed. Then he takes Peter, another one of the top three, and throws him in prison with a plan to have him executed the next day. There's this interesting little story, or not story, but this paragraph in a book written on the 12 apostles by one of my authors that I like, John MacArthur. He says, that son of thunder had now been mentored by Christ, empowered by the Holy Spirit, and shaped by those means into a man whose zeal and ambition were useful instruments in the hands of God for spreading the kingdom. Still courageous, zealous, and committed to the truth, he had apparently learned to use those qualities for the Lord's service rather than for his own self-aggrandizement. And now his strength was so great that when Herod decided it was time to stop the church, James was the first man who had to die. He thus drank the cup Christ gave him to drink. His life was short, but his influence continues to this day. And so the first of the 12 die who were faithful to Jesus. What about John? What happens to him? John, after Jesus' resurrection, appears, along with Peter, to be the first of the apostles who go to the tomb and see that it's empty. A few weeks later, seven of the apostles are up at the Sea of Galilee waiting for Jesus to appear, and they're fishing, something they knew how to do. That would mean Peter, Andrew, James, and John, at least. I don't know if the other three also knew that much about fishing, or they just longed for the boat ride, but... And that's when they see Jesus walking on the shore very early in the morning as it's just coming up on dawn. And this man on the shore says, have you caught any fish? And they said, no. And he says, well, let your nets down on the other side. And so they did. And they catch this great catch of fish. That's the second time Jesus had done that to them. And that's when they knew who it was. But then when they get to shore, Jesus has prepared breakfast for all of them. And he starts to talk to Peter about, do you love me? See, he's having to deal with Peter about having denied him those three times that night of Jesus' trial. But John comes into the conversation. Jesus tells Peter, he says, the day is coming when you will be bound and you will be led where you do not want to go. And the gospel account says Jesus was telling Peter the means by which he would die. And Peter says, Lord, what about John? And Jesus says, if it's my will that he lives until I come back, what is that to you? Jesus was saying, Peter, your responsibility is to me, not to John. You don't need to be worrying about John. I'll take care of John. Well, apparently in the early church, it even came to be believed for a while that maybe John was going to live until Jesus came back because of that story. In fact, we know that John was the last of the apostles to die. He lived all the way up to almost AD 100. And during that period of time, he wrote, towards the end of his life, a gospel called the Gospel of John. Three letters that we have record of. We call them 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John. And he even wrote a book that we still have trouble understanding today called the Book of Revelation. And he wrote it while he was exiled on the Isle of Patmos off the coast of Ephesus and in a very advanced age. But he did eventually die. These were two of the 12 who dared to be disciples of Jesus. And perhaps the most outstanding thing we can say about them today is that they demonstrate how Jesus can take people who may not necessarily look like they would be great disciples of his and turn them into men who would change the world. That says a great deal about what he can do for each one of us and in fact what he has done. We also can be people who, when we let him shape and change us into what he needs us to be useful to him, can make all the difference in the world for others. And we can finally put aside our own desire for advancement You know, there was that time when James and John came along with their mother, probably bringing their mother along, because if she really was the aunt of Jesus, that would give it even extra influence. And they even asked Jesus, whenever you actually become king, can we sit at your right hand and your left hand? And he told them, I can't give you that, because it's not mine to give. But you will drink of the cup that I drink, and you will be baptized with the baptism I'm going to be baptized with. He wasn't talking about the baptism of John there. He was talking about of suffering, persecution, and death. And so they both did. The same is true of us. If we can put him first and ourselves last. We have an invitation song. Encourages us to think about these things and how we are allowing ourselves to be used by Jesus. Is he really first for us? Are we willing to let him change us into what we ought to be? If we can help you in any way in your walk with the Lord, you can come and let us know now while we stand up and sing this song.